This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Aside from the Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele, Walter Freeman ranks as the most scorned physician of the 20th century, writes Jack Alhai in his new biography of Freeman called The Lobotomist. Freeman was the neurosurgeon who coined the term lobotomy with a colleague, championed the procedure, and performed it about 3,400 times. An estimated 40,000 to 50,000 Americans were given lobotomies between the mid-1930s and the 1970s. Proponents of this procedure said it relieved the symptoms of mental illness, but the fact is that many of the patients were left inert, helpless, and broken. The procedure severed the connection between the frontal lobes and the thalamus, a large mass of gray matter that relays sensory impulses to the cerebral cortex.
Freeman and many of his colleagues believed that the thalamus was the center of emotion, and he thought mental illness came from overactive, overly strong emotional signals coming from the thalamus to the frontal lobes. And the person who is the victim of these signals responded to them with what we see as symptoms of illness, hallucinations, depression, feelings of suicide, things like that. So by cutting some of these pathways, he thought that he could dull the symptoms. He wouldn't end the symptoms, but the patient wouldn't be bothered so much by them and wouldn't notice them so much.
You know, I'm thinking like the families of the first patients who had lobotomies. They must have felt really desperate to offer their loved ones for this like new frightening procedure.
You're right, they were desperate, and lobotomy was born from desperation. The situation in America's psychiatric hospitals at that time was terrible and horrifying, not only among the hundreds of thousands of patients who really they were being warehoused there. There were no treatments for them except for the very fearsome shock therapies that were in use then. The electroshock therapy, which was a much cruder therapy than the electroshock that's used now. There was even worse chemical convulsive therapy using a compound called metrazol, which produced convulsions, and then insulin coma therapy, which brought patients to the brink of death, hoping to reboot their brain, in a sense, and restore them to health. That's what was available. And also among the doctors and nurses and other caregivers, they were despondent because all they could do was hold patients and hope for spontaneous recoveries, which didn't happen that often. So desperation was really what lobotomy came out of. And the first patients went into it very willingly.
Would you describe the technique that Freeman developed for the lobotomy?
Yes. There were several techniques. The first is one that would look familiar to all of us because it took place in a general hospital operating room under general anesthesia with a neurosurgeon, James Watts, helping Freeman in the operating room. Sterile draping, gloves, the works, everything that we're used to seeing. And Freeman and Watts would begin by drilling holes in opposite sides of the patient's skull. And through those holes, they would insert a tool, a surgical tool called a leucotome. They used various tools during their careers, but the one that they used the most looked kind of like a butter knife. They would insert that and use the inside walls of the skull as landmarks. They would find the landmarks within the skull to help them find the spots in the brain to make the cuts in the neural pathways. It wasn't an operation that took all that long to do. When the patient recovered or woke up a few hours later, then they tested the patient to see how aware he or she was, and it was a long recovery. There were risks. There was a chance of infection, chance of seizures afterwards. And Freeman later developed a kind of lobotomy called the transorbital lobotomy that he thought could be taken, a portable lobotomy in a sense, that could be taken to the state hospitals and used on these patients. It involved, instead of general anesthesia, the use of the electroshock machine, which most of these hospitals had, to shock the patients into unconsciousness just for 5 or 7 minutes, and that's all Freeman needed. Once the patient was unconscious, then, and you and your listeners will have to bear with me a little bit here, he would lift the eyelid of the patient and insert beneath the eyelid and above the eyeball, so between the eyeball and the eyelid, a sharp tool, which initially was actually an ice pick that he had found in his kitchen drawer when he discovered that all his other surgical tools were inadequate for the job. He would push this tool back until it reached the back wall of the eye orbit, which is one of the thinnest parts of the skull, much thinner than the parts that he and Watts had been drilling through earlier. And with a few taps of the hammer, he could breach that bone and then gain access to the brain. And he had very detailed and specific measurements in mind. You know, he wanted to go 7 millimeters in, cut on an arc of 20 degrees this way and that, and so on. And the advantage of this procedure was he saw it as an outpatient procedure. He thought any doctor could learn to do this, even a doctor who wasn't a surgeon. And Freeman was not a surgeon himself.
I find it incomprehensible how you could do a procedure like this without blinding the person, first of all.
Well, he wasn't going through the eyeball. He was going above it. So he didn't blind them, but they often came out of it with black and blue eyes and bad headaches.
Boy, it seems to be like that would be the least of the problems. It sounds so horrible the way you're describing
it. It does sound horrible. It does sound horrible. But in Freeman's judgment, it worked better. And, you know, when I say in Freeman's judgment, I think one important thing to remember is that standards then were different than they are now. Now psychiatrists, by and large, are interested in helping provide for the happiness of their patients and restoring people to mental health. Back then, when there were few treatments that could do that, and a psychiatrist wouldn't assume that he or she could do that, the goal was more to restore patients to usefulness within society. Freeman saw all these patients in psychiatric hospitals as a terrible waste of potential, and he wanted to get them out and to return them to their families, ideally to return them to their jobs, which did happen sometimes.
What was the typical outcome after he performed a lobotomy, whether it was the more traditional, you know, surgical kind of lobotomy or the transorbital one, which he used the ice pick type of implement?
Well, in the short-term outcome did follow a pattern where the patient went through almost a second childhood. The patient had to be diapered, had to relearn how to eat and talk and walk. Their behavior was childish. They were impulsive, uninhibited, said inappropriate things. Even people who had formerly been straight-laced suddenly began telling dirty jokes and things like that. After that time, then there were a lot of different directions that patients went in, and I think that had to do with the inexactness of the procedure that Freeman was actually, although he was trying to cut the same thing every time, I think he was actually cutting slightly different things every time because of differences in brain anatomy. Mm-hmm. And he estimated that about one-third of his patients were improved. That meant that if they're hospitalized, they got out and returned to their families. Another third of the patients were essentially unchanged. And then the last third were worse off, or in maybe 2 or 3% of the cases, died as a result of the surgery from hemorrhage or from infection.
Perhaps the most famous or infamous lobotomy that he performed was on Rosemary Kennedy, who recently died. And I think most of us, at least I didn't know, that there was somebody in the Kennedy family who had been lobotomized. Who decided on this procedure for her? How did she end up with a lobotomy?
Rosemary Kennedy's case is very puzzling for a number of reasons. What happened was that Rosemary was a different kind of Kennedy child from the very beginning. She was not able to participate in all of the energetic activities that the other children took part in, and she just went her own way. For decades, the Kennedy family has said that she was mentally retarded. I don't believe that. I believe that she had some other kind of disorder, perhaps a learning disability, maybe some brain damage from birth trauma that produced other disorders. I don't know. But I do know that before her lobotomy, she was able to tour Europe without chaperone. She was presented to the Pope and to royalty without any problems. She kept a journal. And she was able to get along. But her behavior was frightening and upsetting to her father, Joe Kennedy. When she was in her early 20s, she was living in a convent home in Washington, D.C., and the nuns were telling Joe that Rosemary was going out late at night, not coming back till the morning hours. He was very afraid that she would become pregnant or come down with venereal disease, and that this would produce a scandal in the family. So he first went to a Boston neurosurgeon to inquire about the chance of her getting a lobotomy. That doctor said no, he wouldn't recommend it. Then Joe Kennedy found Walter Freeman. And Freeman, in consultation with his partner, James Watts, diagnosed Rosemary Kennedy with agitated depression, not mental retardation. Mental retardation was not a reason to receive a lobotomy in Freeman's mind or in anybody else's that I know of. Mm-hmm. She had the lobotomy at the age of 23, and this was in the early 1940s, and it was a disastrous operation for her. She was never the same afterwards, never able to live independently or anything close to independently afterwards, and she lived most of her life in a convent home in Wisconsin.
So, you know, Freeman and a lot of other neurologists felt that, Freudian therapy, talk therapy, was not effective for psychosis. Neurosis maybe, but not psychosis. But on the other hand, all the people they gave the lobotomies to weren't necessarily psychotic. Some of them were had chronic depression or other problems that you probably wouldn't define as psychotic.
Freeman's idea of the ideal patient changed over time. At the very beginning, he was dealing with patients who are very seriously ill and using lobotomy as a last resort treatment. But over time, he changed his thinking, and that was one of the reasons why he eventually split with his partner, his neurosurgeon partner, James Watts, because they disagreed on this. Freeman came to believe that lobotomy is most effective when used in the early stages of mental illness. So he wanted to catch people before they got to the hospital.
So how do you see Freeman now? Do you see him as this kind of monster doctor who mutilated the brains of patients for outcomes that weren't very, very good? Or do you see him as somebody who really did his best in the early history of neurosurgery?
I started my book seeing him as the monster that many people do, and so I can understand that feeling quite a bit. If you were to look at the early drafts of my book, you'd see a much different Freeman than what is in the final version. But as I got into the research and I encountered a mountain of Freeman's papers at the archive that holds his personal and professional papers at George Washington University, I was overwhelmed, not just by the quantity of material there, which made me a little nauseated how much it was, thrilled at the same time because of how much there was, but because of all the dissonant voices that were coming out of it. There was, in great quantity, the voice that I was expecting to hear, the voices of the doctors who disagreed with Freeman and thought he was a criminal. But then also, right alongside that, there were hundreds of letters and, to my amazement, boxes full of Christmas cards from patients. They had sent these to Freeman to express their gratitude, you know, offer him their best wishes. They were inviting him to come to their house for dinner when he was stopping by in their area. They obviously considered him an extended member of their family. This was very unexpected to me.
Did you meet a lot of people who had had lobotomies?
No, I haven't. And one reason for that is there are not many still alive. Mm-hmm. Freeman did most of his lobotomies in the 40s and 50s. Most of his patients were middle-aged or close to middle-aged at the time of their operations. And people in state hospitals had short life expectancies to begin with because of the bad conditions they had gone through and because of their diseases. So the number of names that I could get were limited. One man whose words I use in my book, who had a lobotomy at the age of 12 in 1958. I don't know what he would be diagnosed as having if he were a child now, but his behavior was very violent and destructive then. He almost killed his little sister. Now he's working in San Diego as a school bus driver. And if you were to talk to him, you wouldn't notice anything amiss. So there are a small number of those people out there, but I would guess that of Freeman's 3,400 patients, there are maybe 50 still alive. And I've only encountered a few of them.
There's a very popular lobotomy song by the Ramones called Teenage Lobotomy with lines like, "Guess I'll have to break the news that I got no mind to lose." I assume you know the song.
Yeah.
How does that song sound to you after doing this book? I mean, it's a really upbeat, it's a really kind of fun song. I don't know if it's still fun to you to hear it.
When I first started the book, that song and others like it, you know, the word lobotomy appears an awful lot in rock lyrics, and it bothered me at first because I thought it was trivializing what had happened in decades past. But now I see it as something else. You know, the word lobotomy has really entered our culture and means something different than it did back in the 40s and 50s. It's, you know, a synonym for stupidity and cluelessness and things like that. And I'm now glad that that song by the Ramones and other songs, you know, and Tom Waits' famous phrase, "I'd rather have a full bottle in front of me than a full frontal lobotomy," helps keep the topic alive. And without them, it could be that these patients and this doctor, you know, would vanish into the mist of time.
How did lobotomies go out of fashion?
They began to go out of fashion in the mid-50s when effective pharmaceuticals came onto the market. These were drugs, the main one was a drug called Thorazine, also known as chlorpromazine. And these drugs had a good effect, better than the effect that lobotomy had without the permanent side effects usually. So starting in the mid-50s, there's a gradual slide that lobotomy went into. Through the 50s, through the 60s, even a little bit into the 1970s. And by the end of the 70s, lobotomy was pretty much gone. But that doesn't mean that psychiatric surgery was gone. Psychiatric surgery has continued. To this day, there are a small number of hospitals that have continued to do brain operations to treat psychiatric conditions, mainly depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. They're cutting much smaller regions of the brain than Freeman did, and usually not targeting the frontal lobes. But those are very small in number. What I think will be growing more in the future is a different kind of surgery, surgically implanted devices that deliver an electrical charge to regions in the brain, much like a pacemaker delivers electricity to the heart. And just in the past couple of weeks, the FDA has given approval to a new device that delivers electricity to a nerve in the brain as a treatment for chronic depression. But I do think that Walter Freeman played a big role in bringing to mind or in advancing the biological part of mental illness. He is a big, important proponent of the brain as a factor in psychiatric illness. And I think that's probably his greatest legacy. But I think there is another important lesson to be learned from his life, and that's all about the perilous nature of scientific and medical innovation. Most procedures that people develop don't work or don't work very well. And lobotomy was in that category. And then secondly, it's all about perspective. Now we look back, you know, from this vantage point of a half century and are amazed at how ridiculous the whole idea of lobotomy sounds. That's our perspective. But for the people who were living it back then, it was not a ridiculous idea. It was an idea worth trying. And I agree that it probably was worth trying. And where Freeman failed or where he was faulty was in trying to carry it along for so long.
Well, Jack Elhai, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me here.
Jack Elhai is the author of The Lobotomist, and he's the executive vice president of the American Society of Journalists and Authors.